activated. New York, London, Paris, Munich, everybody talk about
reaching up with Don Fess. Don Fess.
This is Don Fess, and we're reaching up again right now. All together in 204 countries with great in-person guests and music. As I listen to the BBC in the background, I'm back here in London as we update the revolution in Cairo, now in its third week. The day after Hosni Mubarak said that he was not stepping down, the military announced that Mubarak had stepped down after 18 days of protests in Tahrir Square that we all watch all over the world. Chris Elliott, an Egyptologist who has been to Egypt many times, joins me here in London. Blogger Hasim El Hamawawi reports from Tahrir Square in Cairo.
Can you explain to the outside world what exactly is happening here?
Well, right now you have probably 20,000 Egyptians who are still occupying Tahrir Square. The Egyptian government yesterday mobilized plainclothes thugs and policemen who were wearing also, I mean, plainclothes, state security agents, criminals. They mobilized them, you know, I mean, they were armed with sticks, they were armed with knives, swords, Molotov cocktails, even light ammunition. And they were riding horses and camels, and they attacked and they charged against the protesters because they were trying to empty Tahrir Square following the president's speech. But the protesters here held out steadfast, and they managed to rebel them back, which came with, of course, a heavy price to pay. You have at least 1,500 injured people. Those who died, the numbers range between 5 and 7. I cannot confirm how many exactly died. And we're still continuing with the occupation until Mubarak leaves. I mean, Tahrir Square is very significant. This is the biggest square in Cairo. And it's called Liberation Square, and it's been liberated.
Chris Elliott is an Egyptologist here in London who's been to Egypt many times and author of a book on Egyptology in England. Let's start off here in London by me asking you what your background is and how you came to develop a book on Egyptology in London.
Well, my background isn't actually in Egyptology. I came to it quite late. I gradually got into writing and eventually game software development. I was developing games in what I like to call the rock and roll era, which was when, at one point, you could basically get a game, crank it out on cassettes in the back bedroom and make a fortune. Suffice it to say, I didn't make a fortune. Ended up, the industry went into a bit of a meltdown, and I went into teaching, which is in my background, in my family. And along the way, got interested in Egyptology and started studying hieroglyphs, which really gave me the bug, because when you can start to understand the language, start to read the monuments, some of the texts, everything then becomes so much more open to you, and you start to get a much, much deeper insight into the whole culture of ancient Egypt. So I got into it like that, and at one point I was working with a friend and ex-colleague developing websites. And it just so happened that he had done the first website for the London Walks Company. And I just idly said to him, oh, you could do an Egyptian walk from Cleopatra's Needle up to the British Museum. Well, one thing led to another, and it then led to me working on Egyptian London for, I think, probably 10 years now. Because I'd opened a bit of a can of worms, that I thought there would be some connections. I was astonished by how many there were. I'm up now, I think I'm on a database, to something over 250 locations in London with an Egyptian connection of some sort. So getting involved in that, researching it, an awful lot of research before the book was ready. And along the way, I pitched it to a few publishers. One of them was English Heritage, and they said, well, we like the idea, but London's a bit specific for us. Could you broaden it out to include the entire country? And that's the first fruits, if you like, of the project that's coming out.
How did London itself and the rest of England get to have so many places and things, if you will, and exhibits related to Egypt?
London's connections with Egypt are as old as the city itself, and that's no exaggeration, because somewhere, probably buried underneath part of the city of London itself, there's a temple of Isis dating from Roman London, which was when the city itself was founded. So Egypt has had a connection with the city as long as it's existed, and it's surprising quite how that connection persisted right up until the 19th century. But really, the big breakthrough was when Napoleon invaded Egypt in order to cut the British off from India during the Revolutionary Wars with France, and Napoleon took with him 100-plus savants, as the French called them, scholars, engineers, all sorts of different people from the arts and the sciences, whose job was to go out there and study the country. That was one of the things that kick-started the interest in ancient Egypt in Europe. And then when the British basically threw the French out of Egypt, one of the things that we did was to spot what they had uncovered, become aware of it ourselves. And a lot of what we've got in London is a legacy of that, because so much that happened. It's not that there's no stuff outside London. There is, as I know from having researched it. But overwhelmingly, it was concentrated in London, because that was the artistic, the cultural, the intellectual, and the architectural powerhouse, if you like, of England for a lot of the 19th century.
Tell us what kinds of things are in London.
What you've got is the well-known stuff, right, like Cleopatra's Needle and the British Museum. You've also got lesser-known gems. For example, not a lot of people know about the Petrie Museum, which is part of University College London, very close to where we're sitting now. Wonderful, wonderful museum, founded as a teaching collection by Flinders Petrie, who has a good claim to be not only a pioneering Egyptologist, but one of the founders of modern archaeology per se. You've got things like the absolutely wonderful Sir John Soane's Museum, which hasn't got much Egyptian stuff, but what it has got is the sarcophagus of Seti I, which the British Museum lost the chance to have, shall we say. Sir John Soane snapped it up for what was a not-so-small fortune in those days, and as well as being remarkable in its own right, there's all the stories that are attached to it, how it came to be there, who was involved in getting it back, the fact that if you put a light inside it, because it's made of what most people would call alabaster, it's translucent. And when Sir John Soane put it in the museum, he had a series of open days where he invited the great and the good of London, the cultural, intellectual, social elite of London, and inside the sarcophagus were lamps with red lacquered shades so that the whole thing would have glowed from the inside. Now, you can see it, but I think it's twice as wonderful if you know the stories behind it. So there are museums, but not just the ones that people know. There's some very, very good architecture from between the wars, when you had a bit of an Egyptian revival in especially commercial and industrial building. You've got Britannia House, which is a few minutes' walk from the British Museum. Wonderful 1930s Egyptian revival. You've got the incredible Greater London House at Mornington Crescent, built as a cigarette factory for Carreras Rothman, and an absolutely stunning, huge building, stunning Egyptian revival again. And you've also got a little gem, a DIY superstore on the Warwick Road up near Earl's Court. Now, the last thing most people would think of is going up to the Warwick Road looking for a DIY superstore with a carved frieze of ancient Egyptian gods and goddesses on its outside. But it's there. There are London's great 19th century cemeteries, and I think one of the great underestimated tourist attractions of London, they have an astonishing amount of Egyptian connections.
Reaching Up with Don Fess. Don Fess. Used to be a classic
for life. There's a lot of hurting in this society, in this world, maybe even some in you. But the surest way to change things is to be a blessing. Who can you help? Be a friend to. Show some love to. Be the change you want to see. Be a blessing to someone today and every day. This message from Street Cats, One Heart for Kids, and Celebrate Radio. We will choose to be a
blessing for life. This is Don Fass, back with Egyptologist Chris Elliott here in London.
For those people who don't know, tell us what the Egyptian revival that you're talking about was.
Two phases, if you like, of Egyptian-style architecture in England. The first was during the Regency period, late George III, when the Prince Regent took over for his father, who was too ill to reign. Prince Regent became George IV, but the whole period is generally known as the Regency. And in that period, which is the early 19th century, up until about 1820-something probably, the Egyptian style was very fashionable. So you get a clutch of buildings from that period, and then between the two world wars you get a relative rush of it. Again, there's not a huge number of buildings, but there are some very big, very important ones in London, in the rest of the country, which use the Egyptian style. And it's interesting that when it was used for very modern factory buildings, like the Hoover Building out along the Great West Road, which is Thomas Wallace was the architect. People usually think of it as Art Deco, but Wallace was very interested and influenced by the Egyptian style. And then, as I say, you get things like the Carreras Building at Mornington Crescent.
You yourself have been to Egypt, right?
I think I've been to Egypt, trying to think, is it 7 or 8 times now? But yes, I've been to Egypt a number of times, but not enough yet.
I tell people that the one time I went to Cairo, Tutankhamun was on tour like a rock star. He was not in the British Museum, so I missed him there, although I think I saw him in New York. What are your impressions of Egypt itself and of the Egyptian people?
I think it's no exaggeration to say that when I went to Egypt, I fell in love with it. I knew I was interested in the antiquities. What I was struck by was the Egyptian people, who were some of the most friendly people that I've ever come across. It's like travelling anywhere. If you go to the country, if you take it on its own terms, if you treat yourself as a guest in the country, I think, you know, anywhere people tend to respond to it, but particularly in Egypt. I mean, last time I was over, I was helping to put together the new database in the Cairo Museum, in Cairo for enough time to go around a lot of it on foot. And I always felt perfectly secure doing that, which you wouldn't do in a lot of big cities elsewhere in the world. So for me, it's a place that I love because of the Egyptian people.
Are you surprised at all by what's happening now as we... As we sit here in London, there's an Egyptian Cairo newspaper I bought yesterday, a big scene of Liberation Square, where, as we record this, we're in, I think, about week 3 of the uprising. Did any of that surprise you?
Not really. If you look back at Egypt, it's had a history of popular uprisings. I think the Egyptian people have a reputation for being very, very patient, but it comes to the point where enough is enough. I think the British found that after a long relationship with Egypt. Basically, we outstayed our welcome. What's happened is that you've had stability there for 30 years, but stability that's come at a cost. And I think now things have hit that point where it's got to change. You can't go back to the status quo.
I was reading in the London Evening Standard, someone wrote a column about how a lot of revolution's going on just because of economics and the fact that the hardest hit unemployed throughout the world, not just in Cairo, for example, are young people under 30 years old.
Yeah, that's true, because when I've been out there, you talk to people and it's routine for people to do 2 or 3 jobs in order to make ends meet. Incredibly hard-working people, but at the same time, that's contrasted with a degree of conspicuous consumption and affluence, which I think is very difficult for people to take after a while. The fact that the prosperity has been unevenly spread, and after a while people say, well, hang on, you know, we're working hard, but there's a lot of corruption, there's a lot of restrictions on what you can and can't do, and people are starting to say, well, hang on, you know, is the loss of liberty that we have worth the security that we've gained from it?
As I'm sure you've found in your years of research, the Egyptian people and the Egyptian culture is very resourceful, very rich, going back thousands of years, and we all hope that everything straightens out the way it's supposed to. Tell people where they can find out more about your book and how they can find out about touring the hidden Egyptian part of London as well.
The hidden gems of Egyptian London. It's pretty easy, actually. If you just go to www.egyptianlondon.co.uk, it's Egyptian London, all as one word. The website's there. It's got stuff on the book. It's got stuff on the tours and walks. It's got a little quiz you can take to find out how much you know about Egyptian London. for instance, the preserved head of the father of Egyptology is probably not a few hundred yards from where we sit at the moment. So there's all sorts of things.
I'm not sure if I want to go there, but I'll think about it.
You wouldn't. It's not on public exhibition.
Okay. Okay.
But it's interesting to know that most of him is buried in Jerusalem, but his head made it back to the UK at his own personal request. So there's a lot there. But basically, if people look at the website, the tours and walks run them in rotation, probably one day a week regularly. But what I say to people is, if you want to do it, let me know, because things can be customised to people. As far as I'm concerned, if people are interested in visiting Egyptian London, I'd like to be able to take them there.
I thank you very much for being with us, particularly because talking about Egypt is very timely, but then it's been kind of timely for thousands of years, hasn't it?
Basically, Egypt has endured, and I think everybody that loves it will wish it well now and hope that it evolves rather than revolves. So, yeah, let's wish them all the best.
Wasim Waghdi, an activist in the square, tells us his feelings.
Today we are here, I think, for two reasons. We are here to show solidarity with the heroes on the streets in Egypt. We are here to show solidarity with the political prisoners in Egypt. We are here to show solidarity with the workers who declared an open strike and a sit-in until bringing down the regime of Mubarak. And we are here to celebrate a new dawn. A new dawn for the Egyptian people, a new dawn for freedom, a new dawn, a new society in the whole region, not in Egypt. This is something that every single human being who cares for freedom, who wants to live in a more human society and a more humane society, has to celebrate. We are here to do this. It's something I had hoped, against all hope, to happen in my lifetime. And I had hoped, and I think with millions of people, that our children will live in a more human society. But this society, we are lucky enough that the heroes in Egypt are making today. They are not waiting for our children to dream. They are bringing all of our dreams through today in Suez, the factories, in Medan al-Tahrir, the biggest square in the Arab world, is being liberated today from this regime. I can't hear you. It's just... I'm proud to be Egyptian today. I can say this. And I'm proud of all Egyptians today. I'm proud of the masses who are cleansing Egypt of the dirt, of the criminals who have been oppressing us. I'm proud of all the Egyptians who are cleansing themselves of all remnants of fear. I'm proud of an Egyptian people and of the masses who collectively and singly have raised their head up high, and no one will bring it down again. No one. No one. I have to say, in Arabic first. ناديكم أشد على أيديكم وأبوس الأرض تحت نعالكم وأقول أفديكم. I call upon you out there. I kiss the dust under your feet. We say this to the masses of Egypt, to the heroes, to this.
This Egyptian children's cartoon song says why children should think twice about coming into today's world. This is Don Fass. Join us next weekend and keep reaching up. And be sure to tell us where you're listening. Write me at reachinguprradio@gmail.com. reachinguprradio@gmail.
This is the Celebrate Radio Network.
Celebrate Radio Network.
From Montreal to Rio. New York to Moscow.